Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We've got an awesome show for you this week. The Toyota Land Cruiser is coming back. Surprised? Maybe not. I don't know. But hey, let's bring in senior editor for all things electric, John Snyder. We got a great show for you. What's going on?
Ah, man, just happy to be here.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful weather. Gotta roll those. Last time, you know, it was roll the windows all the way down weather. Now it's roll the windows part way up. It's like,
yeah,
in the 50s, but sunny. I like it.
It's 53 degrees right now. Yeah. Literally some sort of ventilation came on last night, and I turned to my wife and I go, is that the heat? Like, what is this here? So we're getting kind of a wild June. I like it. The grass is flipped sort of to green kind of overnight. So that's good. But yeah, so we're doing kind of an early podcast today, 9:30 Eastern time. We don't always do it this early. We're just talking about how hard it is for us to eat breakfast at our busy schedules. I'm like inhaling a bagel. So anyway, so the Land Cruiser's coming back. That'll lead our news segment. We've got news out of the supercharging network with Tesla, some Cybertruck issues as well. We'll talk about the Bolt coming back and a few other things. We have been driving. John's in our long-term Toyota Sienna minivan. He played some PlayStation, or someone did. He also drove an electric school bus, and we've got the Chrysler 300C, the final edition, and the Ford Escape. So we'll get to that, as many of those as we can. Let's just jump right in. I don't know if surprise was the right word that the Land Cruiser's coming back, because we kind of thought it might, but there was also like that sort of note of finality that it probably wasn't going to come back for a while. And when it did, it wouldn't be sort of what it was. It might be different in many ways. But this sounds like they're going to bring the Land Cruiser Prado over here, or tweak the GX, or some, you know, combination of that recipe, and bring it here pretty quick. So, I mean, I like it, you know.
Yeah, the fact that they announced that they're bringing it back like right after they launched the GX, the new GX, seems a little too convenient to be a coincidence.
yeah. So but, I mean. It makes a lot of sense too. I mean, the luxury SUV market for big SUVs, like why wouldn't you want to build a $90,000 SUV that's pure profit, right?
Right, exactly. But yeah, I think, yeah, the Land Cruiser has, you know, mega fans behind it. I'm not really a big fan of huge cars like that, but I grew up in a Land Cruiser. My dad drove Land Cruisers. So I, you know, that's what I was driving when I had my driving permit. And man, it was fun, but yeah, something a little smaller, like the Prado, it's a little interesting because it's going to be bumping up pretty close to the 4Runner, if that's the case. But I mean, the 4Runner feels so, you know, kind of dated now, but I imagine they'll update that at some point soon. So it'll be interesting to see how they position this, you know, within the Toyota lineup.
I could see them using some of the basic, you know, elements like of their, you know, newer upcoming vehicles, and then like stretching the platform a little bit to make it a little more Land Cruiser like, you know. But I mean, I guess we'll see. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's one of their strongest nameplates, you know, it makes sense to make, just makes too much sense to do it. And, you know, I think we'll see this with the 4Runner. They'll maintain like the essence of what it is, but you're going to see like, you know, way more modern, like infotainment, drivetrain, things like that. Like the last generation Land Cruiser was like driving an SUV from 2008, which it is, you know, and that's kind of how the 4Runner is now. So, I mean, I think there could be some good things for people who want to buy a new vehicle, not buy a new vehicle that's actually like almost 20 years old. You know, frankly, a compelling reason to buy the outgoing Land Cruiser was a little bit of nostalgia, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, maybe you liked how cars were 15 years ago. So. Yeah.
Well, yeah. The way it drove definitely felt sort of old and, you know, really sort of squishy suspension. But yeah, the tech inside definitely needed some updating. So we'll see that for sure.
Yeah. And I hope they keep somewhat of the Land Cruiser vibe that they've had, you know, as far as the design element. And I'm sure they will. I don't think this is a vehicle you go too far afield on, but I always liked that. I think it was solid. It's Bluey's car, you know,
the
cartoon dogs. They drive a much older version down in Australia. But all right. So that's a Land Cruiser. I'm pretty excited to drive it. So, all right. Shifting gears, Elon Musk opened up the Tesla Supercharger network to GM customers. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting move. It's like the second time in like 2 or 3 weeks, you know, a Detroit automaker has signed on. Mary Barra did a Twitter Spaces interview with Elon Musk. It's kind of surreal. You know, we get like no notice these things are happening.
Yeah.
And then boom, he's on there. And it's pretty wild. I mean, I think the broader implications, and we were kind of talking about this offline, is like, yeah, we're moving toward a national charging standard. It's Tesla's, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's already pretty well named, that standard, the North American charging standard. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. But no, I think that's a good thing for everyone. That I personally like Tesla's charging standard. Their plugs are nice and small and light, and you know, it's one for AC and DC. You don't have, you know, this chunky little extra blob on there to plug in for DC. And yeah, the sooner we get to just one standard across the industry, the better the charging experience will be for everyone. There's going to be some growing pains in there with, you know, compatibility and things like that. 'Cause Tesla's, you know, if you're a Tesla charging a supercharger, it's really seamless. You plug in and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And that's the case with some other vehicles have plug and charge on, you know, CCS, but, I don't know how well that's going to work with, you know, GM or Ford's. If you plug into a Tesla supercharger, you know, or if a Tesla plugs into, you know, a non-Tesla charger, it's not going to be quite as seamless as that, at least at first, until they, you know, get it all organized under one roof, work out those kinks, and then it will be a better experience for everyone, in my opinion.
No, I think charging has to be a thing where, like, you don't think about it. You know, it just works.
Yeah,
I've had some issues with charge point stations recently, and it's been a little frustrating. You know, and it's everything from the app to, you know, the way you have to position the car sometimes, to just randomly they don't work, you know, and that's frustrating. So I actually enjoy charging the electric vehicles that come through our test fleet. I just think it's an interesting kind of fun thing to do that, you know, I don't have that same vibe about going to fill up like whatever car I've got to gas up at the end of the week. But it's kind of neat to do it. So, you know, it's, you know, Ford and GM have talked about adapters, which will make it easier, if you will. There's a lot of fine print here, a lot of sort of devil in the details that needs to be worked out.
But I think another thing to consider is that Tesla is rumored to be coming out with a version 4 of its superchargers. In the near future, maybe next year, and those will be, you know, capable of 350 kilowatt charging, and will have longer cords. So, you know, the problems right now of, you know, the way that the chargers are positioned and which side the cord is on and all that, and people having to park in the spot next to it to charge, that sort of thing. That will hopefully be addressed with this new new supercharger version that's going to be coming out, and yeah, that then, you know, 350 kilowatts, it will be, you know, right up there with Electrify America in terms of charging speed, and I think you know, if any Tesla owners are out there, I think they'll probably say that, yeah, they probably have a better charging experience anyway. Yeah. They tend to charge closer to their peak rate than, you know, other EVs do when you plug them in. A lot of times you plug in at a 350 kilowatt charger in our EV6 and it just doesn't get anywhere. It, you know, it maxes out like what, 235 or something, but it doesn't get anywhere close to that. Especially if it's cold.
Yeah.
And, you know, it, and if the batteries, you know, it takes a long time for it to actually get anywhere near that peak charging point. Whereas Tesla, I think they have a little bit better, you know, more standard charging rate throughout the charge experience.
It's interesting too. It seemed to almost catch the government a little flat-footed, because a couple days later they announced, you know, a big plan for the CCS connectors. It was kind of like, I don't know. Did you guys know that like Ford and GM were going to do this? Maybe not. Because I mean, when you look at Ford, GM, and Tesla, the number I'm seeing is 60% of the EV market. So
yeah,
you know, that's a lot of, you know, that's like, I mean, when you think of American consumers, you've got Tesla for electrics and Ford General Motors for everything else and electrics, you know, as far as just pure household domestic names. So, you know, we'll see. And maybe, you know, you might get to a point where like, and I think during the transition period, there'll be like a menu of chargers. You pull up, there'll be CCS, there'll be NACS, that type of thing. People will be having adapters. Long term, like you just said, though, I don't think that's the way to go. You just want to pull up, not worry about the adapter, pull in just like the gas station, you know?
Yeah, it'll just be people with older EVs that will have to worry about the adapter. Everyone else, you know, all the new ones that you buy will be, you know, just be easy.
All right. So this is just pure eye candy. We kind of got to talk about it, though. The Porsche Mission X, it's a hypercar. It's a concept. It's sort of like a signpost for like the next Porsche hypercar, sort of following the footsteps of, like, you know, remember the 918 and things like that. Yeah, Porsches do. I think this works. For what it's worth, I've been looking at a lot of different like hyper and supercars from a variety of different places. This one's tasteful. You know what I mean? Like, it looks pretty good. Whereas like if you look at like Rimac and some of the other ones that go way out there, like, this looks, I think, pretty good.
It does look good. It is a little bit out there for Porsche, but they do have, you know, I mean, it's an electric vehicle. They have the opportunity to make it a little different, to, you know, position the batteries where you want it. And yeah, basically it looks like, yeah, you know, sort of mid-engine format, even though it's, you know, no engine.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks that has that sort of format, and yeah, it's beautiful, very race-y, you know, race-ish, with the all the chronograph inside and the lap timers and that wild steering wheel. Very much looks like it's borrowed from one of the open wheel racing series. But yeah, this thing is really cool. And Joel's piece on it, some of the details about it, I like that it has an animal mascot. There's a little cheetah badge hidden, very, very cleverly, you know, sort of on the rear fender, sort of under some of the aero. It looks really cool. And the way the doors open up, man, this thing it's beautiful. And the seats are something else.
Yeah, the headlights look pretty good too. That's like, they're like, you know, they go right across the fenders to like inches off the ground. It's really cool. It kind of brings back some of like Porsche's like Le Mans heritage, you know, thrown in here a little bit, which I think is good.
Yes, very much.
All right. So check that story out. Joel has a nice follow-up piece where he breaks down some of the key elements of the Mission X. Check that out.
We don't really have... Really good. We don't really have specs on it because it's a concept, but gosh, it's a beautiful design study.
Indeed, indeed. All right, so maybe this is still a design study. It's apparently on the way to production, but we had a piece come last week about how leaked documents show significant early issues with Tesla Cybertruck. Our breathless headline reads. So I'm just curious, you know, the Cybertruck, I feel like, is at a point where it kind of needs to get here. That's my takeaway. And this story just kind of reiterates that, you know. I mean, what do you think is up with the Cybertruck?
I don't know. I think it might just be Elon Musk's sort of clean sheet look at the process, the way mm-hmm. he goes about developing cars, combined with this being such a different vehicle. You know, it's very much not like your typical, you know, cabin bed truck. You know, total clean sheet design. It's of course you're going to run into problems, but this report makes it sound like the problems are pretty fundamental. They're bad, like mm-hmm. you know, not sealed. Problems with the braking, suspension, and leaks and noise, and it sounds like a lot of stuff that at this point those should be pretty well figured out.
Yeah, the report comes from a German newspaper, and then it was picked up again by Wired, and that's when, you know, American outlets like us kind of realized what was going on. It is like rudimentary stuff, like blocking and tackling, like bodywork, yeah. seals, stuff like that. You know, noise handling, braking, suspension. To read more from our story, that's odd. And honestly, I think it's a missed opportunity if that stuff is what's holding them up, because mm-hmm. that's not really something that has to be unique to the Cybertruck. Like, that's just a thing that you should have figured out for any new vehicle. Now, can stuff go wrong with any new vehicle? Of course it can. Look at some of the launch issues Ford has had in the last couple of years, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those things where I think context and perspective is fair, but it's also like, you know, the revolutionary part of this is the design, some of the different like G-Wiz features, the fact that it's an all electric pickup truck, like that, those are the selling points. Like, you know, the other stuff, it seems like you just need to like, you know, kind of figure out. It's like if, you know, you have some, like, I don't know, use a football analogy, like every now and then you'll like, maybe the team you like is really good, but like they don't have a kicker. And you're like, how do we keep losing games? Because the guy misses wide right, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it can be frustrating. So that to me is what this feels like. I went to one of those Monroe, they're like a local, like, industry sort of analysis firms, such as it is. And they did a breakdown of a Tesla model. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about just how sophisticated everything was except the build quality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, take it for what it's worth. It was a walk around. They, you know, they had their own, you know, reasons for doing it, but they invited the press to come look at it. And, you know, I don't think it's like dunking on Tesla to say like it's odd that they have quality issues with like build quality. So to me, that's where you just get into this missed opportunity. And, you know, like, come on, I think this could be a real home run. I don't know. I don't know the reasons for them, though.
Yeah. It's one of those reasons why I wish, you know, we would see Tesla. I mean, we're seeing them collaborate with, you know, Ford and GM on charging and stuff. I would like to see them collaborate with someone on manufacturing, you know. They could give their technology to somebody and then in turn maybe get some materials from another supplier and maybe avoid some of these problems. I'd hate to see the Cybertruck released as sort of a half-baked product and then Tesla sort of fixing it on the fly as the first owners are basically their guinea pigs for mm-hmm. you know, what's going to go wrong in the real world. As you know, Tesla seems to do with,
yeah,
I mean, that was sort of the case with the Model 3. You know, sort of the case with full self-driving.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just, you know, it's, they need to get that part. They need to get the part where they build something and it's complete before they put it out. And I think they might need help with that. But
yeah, I mean, someone like you wrote a column saying, hey, it's good when Tesla works with other automakers because in some ways everybody wins.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
They sort of have the secret sauce in many fronts, but then there's just these other, like, you know, almost very unthinkable mistakes they make, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe that's what makes them Tesla, is they can move fast and reach these like hills that other companies don't even go for, but then you kind of maybe miss sight of what's in front of you. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. It's, I don't know if we will, but people will be driving the Cybertruck, I think, somewhat in the near future, you know, but we'll see how it goes.
And we could be wrong. Everything could be hunky-dory when it comes out. I know for sure that people are going to love it when it comes out. I mean,
I think I'm going to like it. I like that era of wedge-shaped design that the Cybertruck harks back to. Like, you know, you want to, you know, show me like mid-70s to kind of mid-80s wedge-shaped cars. Sign me up for that all day, whether it's a Lancia or like an Escort or something. So, you know, I'm on board with that.
Yeah. But,
all right, so let's transition to the Chevy Bolt is coming back. And, yeah, I think it's probably coming back. Mary Barra strongly hinted to NPR that the Bolt would be coming back, probably with Ultium Power. That's their new battery pack, their new sort of, you know, setup. You've had an up close look at it. The Bolt sort of went away for a few reasons. One, they needed a place to build some other higher value vehicles. Like, I believe it's a factory in Michigan is going to build Lake Orion is going to build the Silverado EV. And it's like, where are we going to make more money here? The Chevy truck EV or the Bolt compact car? Mm-hmm. So somebody gets kicked off the island. It also wasn't quite selling as well. It had an older battery setup that didn't charge as quickly, although the range was still very respectable.
It was, yeah.
And of course,
it's great to drive too.
It was great to drive too. And then just real quick, they had some big issues with that. Big recall, potential fires. Yes. So, like, I mean, just goes to show you, like, any car company could really screw up. So it's like, you know, anybody who's listening to this thinking, oh, are they dunking on Tesla? Well, no, we dunk on everybody when they screw up. And the Bolt had some pretty unthinkable problems.
Yeah, that battery thing was a nightmare.
That was bad, really bad. But it sounds like it's coming back. And I don't think the image of the Bolt was damaged so much that it's a problem. I think, you know, I still see a lot of them on the road. I've seen them in other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. I think it did find an audience because people like the idea of a $30,000-ish compact crossover car. It drove great.
Yeah. When they came out with the Equinox pricing, you know, saying, you know, it's going to start around 30,000, it's like, you know, with the Bolt as it is, why would you buy the Bolt over that unless you're confined to a small parking spot?
Yeah. New Equinox looks really good, I think. Yeah. And it offers you a lot of, you know, functionality for what it was, for the price and for the size. I actually took it to a Bronco drive. This is a couple years ago, local drive. And I drove the Bolt up to Hollyoaks, just north of the city. Uh-huh. And I remember thinking, this thing's great. I am not as excited to drive the Bronco off-road because, you know, come on, right? Yeah. But it was still a very memorable part of that day. So, you know, the Bolt had its supporters. I'll be curious to see, like, if they could carve out that almost like commodity EV. And I think for GM, that would be a great move. There's not that many, there really aren't that many options for people who, you know, are less affluent and don't want to spend a ton of money on, you know, a larger electric crossover or car.
For sure. Yeah. Especially if it's something that you don't drive very much. Like I considered getting a Bolt just because I wouldn't drive it very much, but you know, I don't have a personal daily driver myself right now. And that would be the perfect second car for our household, something to run the kids around town, that sort of thing. We've got the Palisade for the bigger trips. But yeah, if they bring the Bolt back with Ultium technology, slot it under the Equinox and give it a nice low price, yeah, it'll be great.
Cool. So speaking of things coming back from the dead, we'll run through a couple items here real quick. Those barn find Ferraris that went up for auction, I mean, holy cow, man. Like, the one that was, like, designed by Pininfarina and was just, like, a wreck. They, like, it wrecked in a race, like, 60 years ago, and then they left it. It's sort of our lead image, so you should check the story out. It's pretty wild. And then you can click through to some of the links in the RM auctions catalog and see some of the, like, the different more details. Some cool stuff in there that you could definitely concours ready, but that was the one that stood out to me. I was like, holy cow, this is just wild.
Yeah, but there's some really neat cards in that collection for sure. The 20 lost Ferraris and some nearly destroyed.
Yeah.
There's a wide variety of conditions there. And it's neat to see that. I love barn finds. They're just,
yeah, me too.
Such an exciting thing.
Yeah. So check those out, click through the pictures and, it's definitely worth your time. That's the kind of thing I like to read when I had more time on, like, Saturday and Sunday mornings, is, you know, going the, like, retro kind of old Ferraris and, you know, different sites. Like, the New York Times Wheels blog, when it was a thing, was good at that. We like to think we're pretty good at that. So check it out. It's a pretty cool story. Did you catch any of Le Mans last weekend? Speaking of old racers and Ferraris.
I did not.
Yeah, I did a little bit, and I don't know. I think it's, I used to go to, like, some ALMS races back when I worked for Auto Week, and, I saw some of the IMSA stuff, more recent. Yeah, I've seen that more recently. It's kind of a cool watch, you know. It's on for 24 hours. Yeah. You can come and go as you want, and I thought it was cool to see Ferrari come back and win. It was unfortunate that the Toyota race car got hit with a squirrel or ran over a squirrel or inhaled a squirrel. That sounded bad. Such a cool race though, you know, and it's, some of our correspondents were there, all the history, all the, just such a high level of competition, the element of danger that goes into it, the way the automakers get so fired up about it. Mm-hmm. Every year I try to watch some of it, a little bit of Sebring, maybe a little bit of, like, the Rolex 24 at Daytona. Like, I'm not the biggest, like, endurance car racing fan, but it's just, I really appreciate it, especially being in the business. And they're like little touchstones throughout the year. So I don't know. I think Le Mans is always a nice kind of sort of kickoff to summer.
It is fun to have on, you know, if you're just doing stuff and then you just leave it on the TV and check in on it throughout the day.
Yeah.
It was also pretty interesting how, I feel like it made a little more noise this year. Automakers were using Le Mans as a sort of, a soapbox for, you know, upcoming products. Like Ford, showed its, Mustang that, it's Le Mans Mustang that it's going to be, racing in the future, and that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Toyota took the chance to introduce Kamui Kobayashi as its new NASCAR driver.
Yeah,
which I think is also pretty cool. He's a great racer. Le Mans winner. Didn't do so well in F1, but it'll be interesting to see how he does in NASCAR. But Le Mans is a great world stage for, you know, any automaker to sort of make some announcements, and it's also a really good test bed for technology, especially, you know, hybrid and electrification and stuff. So I've always wanted to go. I've never been.
Yeah, me too.
To the race. I think that'd be fun. It'd be a challenge to cover and to stay awake and alert through the whole thing. But, going, moving around from corner to corner and just, you know, staying up for the whole 24 hours would be quite the experience.
Sounds good. Sounds good. I would like to go too. I'd like to go where that would just be on the bucket list of things to do, yeah. You know, and it kind of wreck you. I would imagine for like a week, you'd come home and probably try not to do too much for a few days, but, it's awesome. So, yeah. All right. So let's talk about what we've been driving. We've got some cool stuff. Going to lead things off with the final drive of the Chrysler 300C. It is, you know, it's a car I have a lot of thoughts about. It arrived, this is Wednesday. It arrived later Monday. It actually arrived early Monday. And in one day, I burned through like a third of a gallon, a third of a tank of gas. I've just been driving it. It's got that visceral sound, the rumble, even when you're just sitting there at idle. I usually back into my driveway and then gun the engine a few times. In case you're wondering what exactly this is, maybe you missed the email, if you will. So this is the 300C. They haven't actually sold the 300C per se since 2020. You could still get the 5.7 liter V8, which is a pretty big engine, like 363 horsepower. But that was more like available on the 300S. So it wasn't the C, you know, that iconic car that goes back to like the 50s, even as far as being like the real, you know, 300 muscle car. So the C is back and it's got a big badge on the grill and on the seats to let you know that. And they didn't just say, hey, we're going to give you the letter. They dropped in the 6.4 liter Hemi V8, naturally aspirated, 485 horsepower. It's a riot. You know, I think there were some rumors they might do Hellcat. I don't think you need to do it. You know, this is the 300. You know, it's a little bit like classier, a little bit maybe bougier. Like, you don't need all that. It sounds right. It's a ton of power. It's basically a Chrysler Scat Pack. So that's the big engine and not much else aside from some design stuff, which to me is all you need.
Yeah, it's the best setup, I think. The Scat Pack is the way I would go.
100%. I very few people I have actually, there's a couple, but in our, like, usually in the podcast, I would always do Scat Pack over Hellcat or, you know, like any Demon, if you will. To me, this is it. And it's a very fitting send off for, you know, Chrysler icon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be weird to see it go, but it's funny. Wally, my son, was asking me over the weekend, he's like, what cars does Chrysler make? Because he could only think of the Pacifica.
Well,
there's the 300. He's like, I don't even know what that is. I'm like,
right, right. I mean,
kind of forgot that it exists, you know?
And that's kind of like, that's kind of what I'm writing too, is like, you may have forgot about the 300. Because Chrysler seems to have forgotten about the 300, quite frankly.
But yeah, I remember seeing this at the Detroit show and taking a look around it, and you know, it looks fairly normal. There's some badging and you know, some embroidery inside. But when you open the hood, that's when you realize that this is something different. But yeah, it is a really cool send off for the 300.
2,000 for the US, 200 for Canada. I believe they're all spoken for. You know, it's my guess is that they will bring back the 300. We don't know what it's going to be, but the Land Cruiser's back. We think the Bolt's coming back. It's actually somewhat rare for very successful names to totally disappear. So, I mean, Chrysler has used the 300 name. They used it in the 50s and 60s. They've used it for years. Sometimes it takes a couple decades off. It's too good of a name not to use. So I imagine it'll be back. And, you know, just driving it, it reminds me just how significant this car was for Chrysler. You know, it's that LX platform that, you know, they ended up using for the Charger, the Challenger, the Dodge Magnum deep cut. And I think it was really the first successful, like, thing that the Germans and the Americans came together and made after that Daimler-Chrysler merger. Because you remember the first try was... One of the first tries was the Chrysler Crossfire, which didn't go great. You know, not great, Bob. So, although some people did like that SRT version of it. So this was, not only did this go well, it was a home run. It won every Car of the Year award you can think of. It totally reset the industry. I remember how annoyed GM and Ford execs were. They're like, well, great, Chrysler has one car. And I remember reporters would be like, well, how many do you have in 2006? And the answer was not many, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's a good send off. Let's put it that way. I'm having fun driving this thing. Yeah. So, check out the site. The story probably won't be up by the time this publishes, but, likely in July, I'll probably have a pretty good write up. And I think I might try and go into like some of the older neighborhoods, in the Metro Detroit area, try to get that kind of old feel,
yeah,
flair. There's this like 1920s mansion that was listed in, I think, Palmer Woods, that I kind of just want to like you got to drive the car. You might as well drive it somewhere.
Right.
Try to go take some pictures over there. Maybe
that'd be cool.
So we'll see where the week takes me. Maybe a Cars and Coffee. All right. So you've been playing PlayStation on the clock, apparently, in the Sienna. How's that going?
Well, let's see. I wanted to test out the Rear Seat Entertainment because okay. I hadn't.
Yeah.
Rear Seat Entertainment systems. I don't know. Nowadays, you know, when tablets and you know, your phone can play movies, doesn't seem all that practical. So mm-hmm. I tested it out. And the Rear Seat Entertainment in the Sienna, it's a single screen that comes down from the ceiling in the middle. And then there's an HDMI input. There's an inverter, you know, so there's a plug on the back of the center console. So I took my PlayStation out there and plugged it all in and you know, opened up the screen, and I couldn't get the PlayStation to power up. There's a little button to the left of the steering wheel on the dash that you have to press to turn on the AC plugs in the back. There's one on the back of the center console, and there's one in the cargo area. And you have to press it every time you want to activate those plugs. It turns off every time you turn off the car. So once I remembered that thing existed, I was able to fire it up, and it fired up and worked just great. No power issues. There's plenty of power. I think there's like 1500 watts available through the inverter. And the quality is okay, but it's 1080. The thing is, the screen, when you fold it down, it blocks your view out the back through the rear view mirror. Now, you can get a digital mirror, you know, the camera feed through the mirror, but our tester doesn't have that. So you're driving around, you know, kind of blind, as though you're full up of cargo with that. And then, you know, it comes with a couple of wireless headphones, so you can either play it through the speakers or through the headphones. And if you're doing it through the headphones, then whoever's driving can still listen to whatever they want. But you know, when a package like this costs, you know, $1,700, it doesn't make sense really to me anymore. And especially like the one screen, everyone wants their own screen. And, you know, I like the having the screens on the back of the headrest. If you're going to have, you know, fixed screens at all, having them on the back of the headrest is a little better. You know, if you want to watch anything from the second row, you're both passengers are going to be craning their necks to look at it. But you know, everything did run seamlessly. I didn't have to troubleshoot anything to get the, except for that button, to get the you know, the display to work. Yeah, it was just pretty seamless, pretty plug and play. But it just seems, I don't know. I wouldn't spend my money on a Rear Seat Entertainment system, especially this one. Maybe yeah. maybe some of the other ones that have, you know, apps built in, like YouTube and Netflix and stuff, like either, you know, some of the other, like Kia Carnival, I think has some of those, and that seems like a better fit for today. But yeah, you know, but yeah, I just went up north in it, and Wally, you know, just had a tablet that he watched a movie on, rather than watch anything on that that you have to plug things into.
Yeah, we had the BMW 760 with the fold down like theater screen, which was insane.
Oh yeah, that's
it's a lot, man.
Yeah, that's a whole different ball game there.
For what it's worth, though, I tend to agree with you. You can get like 60 to 80% of like your entertainment value with an iPad or something. Mm-hmm. Like, it almost seems like automakers don't need to invest as much in some of these, like the hardware and having defined hard points for them. You know, like, I mean, I think a lot of people are very happy just having phone time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. Cool. So you've been driving the Escape. Mm-hmm. That is, I haven't driven an Escape in quite some time. I remember, like, so this is like the refresh, and you had the it's the ST line, right?
Yep.
That's kind of gnarly. How was it?
It was good. I like the looks of the refresh, and then the ST line, I think, really makes this look better. You know, body color cladding, and you know, this one had the black wheels. It had the red paint and the black wheels. It just looked a lot sportier than, you know, any other Escape I've ever driven. So, I mean, the Escape is a pretty, you know, fun crossover, you know, compact crossover to drive, you know, compared to some of the other mainstream compact crossovers. It's, you know, pretty tight handling. It's and then with the EcoBoost 4, the 2-liter EcoBoost, plenty of power on tap. So it was nice to have some of the looks to go along with it. You know, bigger spoiler in the back. And then, yeah, the updated front fascia with the new headlights and new grill. And then the ST line had this nice black mesh on the grill. So yeah, the looks of the ST line, a little better vibe with how the car actually drives. The ST line Elite, which this was, you know, there's three different ST line trims. The ST line Elite has a light bar that goes across just underneath the hood between the headlights, and it looks really good at night. And it kind of reminds me of the F-150 Lightning, only, you know, shrunken down. And then it's got the new front fascia. It looks a little more like the Ford Edge. So it's sort of borrowing DNA from other Ford vehicles and tying it all together. And then inside, the refresh gets this new 12.3-inch infotainment display, running Sync 4. And it's quite the improvement. Man, that screen is really, really crisp. Just one of the clearest screens I've seen. And pretty easy to use. But yeah, it was nice to drive. It was nice to reacquaint myself with the Escape. The interior, you know, this ST Line Elite had, you know, nice leather seats and some nice, you know, carbon fiber looking trim. Sort of distracts you from the, you know, black plastics that sort of are all over the Escape. This seems a little less of a desert of black, black plastic. So yeah, it was nice. I still like the Escape. It's a little on the pricey side, but, every time I get in one, I enjoy driving it. And, I like it a little bit better now with the updated looks and, the availability of this ST line appearance package.
Yeah, I think the update is a good move for them. And I think adding that package makes a lot of sense too, because I think there's a lot of people who, I'm always surprised how many people check that box for like crossovers. Like, yeah, I'll take the sporty-ish package, even if it's just an appearance. But
yeah,
good way to make a little more money. And I think the consumers like it too.
Yeah. And on this one, it really just makes the car look a little less drab. And yeah, it gives a little bit of personality, which I think the Escape needed.
All right. So you drove a school bus this week. That's pretty wild. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So it's this company called Lightning E-Motors, and they basically have three products right now. They have a Ford Transit van that they electrify. They have a GM, you know, Class 4 chassis that they electrify, that they use for, you know, school buses, shuttle buses, things like that. And then they have a mobile DC charger. So it's a trailer with, you know, up to like four or five charge points on it that, you know, for rescues or for if you need to set something up at a job site or something like that, or a, you know, a temporary installation. But yeah, I actually got to drive the Transit and the GM one, which was the, in this case, it was an electric school bus, one of the, you know, smaller school buses. And yeah, it was, I haven't driven a gas or diesel powered school bus before, but I was really shocked at how easy it was to drive this one. They even set up some cones and could do a little slaloming in this parking lot on Belle Isle. It was pretty neat.
Nice.
Yeah. So I think right now is a tipping point for electric school buses. It's been sort of ignored for too long, but it's a way a lot of, you know, fleets could save money. You know, in the long run, you're paying probably close to double up front when you buy an electric school bus as opposed to a diesel one. But you know, your costs of operating are far, far, far less. You know, it's a big area of concern for a lot of states and and municipalities is air quality and climate. So yeah, moving to electric buses is sort of an underserved niche in the market, and yeah, Lightning is aiming to serve that, at least for, you know, some of the smaller operations. But you know, some of the longtime makers like Bluebird and stuff are going electric now too. So I think we're going to start to see a lot more electric school buses. But yeah, driving that was really fun. Pretending I was a bus driver, and you know,
nice.
You have that weird handle that you pull to open the door. it's always fun to get to drive something like that that you don't get to drive every day, and the fact that it was electric. Made it even more fun. It's, you know, super quiet. They have basically one level of regen baked into it. Customers can sort of specify what they want, and you can get over the air updates. And another one thing this company does is they have really good fleet management system, and you know, they take all the data from all the cars that they have out on the road. And if you go to their website, you can sort of plug in what your fleet would be doing, your route, your, you know, uptime, downtime, all that stuff, temperature of where you're going to be. And it will tell you which vehicles would work for you. It's kind of neat just that they're using that, that information in real time. Every time they get new, it's constantly updating, the algorithm, but
that's interesting.
Yeah, that was neat.
It's interesting because when you think of the use cases for a lot of school buses, they put a lot of miles on between, say, 7 a.m. and like 9 a.m. Most of them sit for a while. They go back somewhere. Many districts have like holding yards or places they like refuel.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to put diesel in them. You could just go to a big charging bank, you know, and then, you know, then from like 3 to say 5, they get used again, come back, charge them up for another, you know, whatever. And, you know, away you go. It's in some ways, it's a very, very ideal use case.
Yeah. And they've got vehicle to grid technology. So when they're just sitting there, you know, they could sell money. I mean, sell energy back to the grid, yeah. And you know, it takes your cost of operations even lower. And yeah, so they've got in San Diego at the airport. I think San Diego. They're running these Lightning e-motors shuttle buses from one of the parking lots. And then DHL is a customer for their transit. And you know, they've got modular batteries, you know, scalable batteries. And so DHL's California fleet has, you know, three of these 40 kilowatt hour packs in their trucks. But in New York, they only have one in there, you know, which is about, you know, I think 60 miles of range, because, you know, New York is built very vertically. So they're not driving very far. Which I thought was kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see, like, different, you know, automotive executives who I've kind of interviewed over the years have often said, like, you know, cars are important, but doing like buses, you know, heavy duty machinery, those things are big. They drive a lot and they put out a lot of pollutants. If we could kind of do that, you're like, you know, you're taking a big swing at things, you know, and arguably it's more important to make like a school bus electric than it is to make somebody, you know, turn in a Chevy Cruze that's getting 30 miles to the gallon, you know?
Yeah.
It's taking a big swing at a problem and, you know, could be interesting.
Yeah, and there's some interesting use cases like mining where, you know, if you fill something up with a load at the top of a hill and drive it down the hill, it actually gets more in regen going down the hill than it needs to go back up empty. So it's like almost it's free energy, it almost seems like. So
free energy, I think that's what we're all going for, right?
Yeah, ideally.
All right, so that's the drive section, and that's all the time we have. It's been a good show. I think we've run through a lot of different things. Please send us your Spend My Monies. That's podcast@autoblog.com. If you enjoy the show, we'd love to get 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the show. Please tell a friend about it. You know, we try to get the word out. Hope a lot of enthusiasts enjoy the Autoblog podcast. So that's it for this week. Be safe out there, and we'll see you next time.